This is Sherry Levitin with the Heart and Sell podcast series, and we are chatting with some of the most amazing sales leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and top performers in sales. This podcast is in celebration of you and your commitment to sell with heart and authenticity. You can pre-order my new book at heartandsell.com and enjoy this full podcast and many more as part of your purchase. And remember, what you do matters, but who you are matters more. This is Sherry Levitin with the Heart and Sell podcast series, and I am thrilled today to introduce to you best-selling author Colleen Stanley, who wrote Emotional Intelligence for Sales Success. I got to tell you, when I read this book, my first thought was, God, I wished I had written that. It really is so well written, and to me, it provides salespeople the missing link. For years, salespeople have been taught what to say, when to say it, and even why to say it. But what Colleen's going to share with us is why they know this and don't do it. She talks about that in her book. Colleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sherry, thank you for having me as your guest, and thank you for the kind words about the work we do.
It really impacted me, and I know it's impacted so many others. I'm going to start with a series of questions, Colleen, about the book itself, and then we're going to get a little up close and personal, if you don't mind. What is the knowing and doing gap? I love the phrase. What is it?
Well, you know, the knowing and doing gap, and you set it up very nicely in our conversation, is, you know, we live in a day and age where there's an explosion of technology, there's an explosion of information. So salespeople don't lack the resources on being very competent and professional in their selling roles. They have been taught value propositions, handling objections, ask more questions, listen more than you ask, and yet, most prospects and customers would tell you they're not observing that type of behavior on a sales call. So salespeople know what to do, but in selling situations, often emotions start running the meeting rather than effective selling and communication skills. It's the classic knowing-doing gap.
I love that, what you said, emotions start running the meeting. I heard the phrase the other day, are you engaging in emotional selling or are you selling emotionally? And of course, the latter is what we don't want to do. How does that affect salespeople when they let the emotions run the meeting, Colleen?
Well, a couple of common areas that I see are, you know, you get with the good negotiators. And as the old saying, negotiators negotiate. And so they may start using some of those proven tactics. And the sales rep has just attended a workshop, maybe conducted by their sales manager, where the entire sales team was cheering, saying, we sell on value, not price. And then the minute they get in front of that tough negotiator, they drop price.
Right.
And so they know what to do, and yet that tough negotiator can start triggering them. They can go into what we call the fight or flight response. It's an emotional response in certain trigger events. And at that point, the emotions start taking over rather than what we know that we should do.
And what are some of these, if they're in that fight or flight, they've got, of course, fear and anxiety. And how does that work? How does it trigger them to not act appropriately?
Well, you know, I'm a health major, so I find some of this work fascinating, and that's why I probably latched onto it as a sales trainer once I was introduced to the concept. But I always say sales is a combination of biology, physiology, and consultative selling. So to answer your question, what can happen is your prospect has just triggered you. And if you're not highly aware, your body actually starts moving into a physiological reaction, fight or flight. Blood starts leaving the brain, which carries red blood, and red blood cells carry oxygen. So you're becoming oxygen deprived. When you're in a fight or flight situation, your body shoots off adrenaline because you've got to get ready to fight or flight. And then the other thing it does is it releases cortisol, a stress hormone. So Sherry, let's take a look at this. You're in front of that tough negotiator. They're saying, you know, I've got 100 people that want my business. Why you? Why are you higher priced? All of the proven tactics that a good negotiator uses. And the salesperson literally becomes oxygen deprived, and they can't even think of the right things that they learned in the seminar, podcast, or workshop. So that's where the execution gap comes into play, because you're actually allowing a physiological reaction to take over that meeting. And that would also be considered the emotional reaction.
Right. And I'm sure that happens in closing. It happens in, you know, trying to get through to a prospect in the very beginning. And maybe even before, if a salesperson is short on cash, they're nervous, they walk into the meeting in this sort of fight or flight with cortisol and all of these chemicals running around in their brains.
Exactly. And, you know, we all know that somebody can spot your energy level, because even if you're not into what some of my clients refer to as the woo information, I ask them this question. Have you ever walked into a room and you sensed something was going on? Everyone will raise their hand. Well, your prospect is the same way, and they can sense if you're confident, self-assured, and genuine. However, you know, when you really start going into this fight-or-flight reaction, you start becoming actually very self-focused, self-centered, because you're more worried about what's going on inside than being able to pay attention to the most important person on the call, which is that prospect or client.
All right, so I'm a salesperson. My heart's pounding right now. I'm nervous. Maybe I'm speaking in front of a large group, maybe a big negotiator, and I know it's happening. I feel it. I feel the fear. What do I do? What emotional intelligence skill do I need? And how do I snap myself out of my fear zone?
Okay, so great question. And one of the things to understand with the fight or flight response, you can't always stop the fight or flight, because it comes from the reptilian brain. So it can override that logical prefrontal cortex, right? But what you can do is you can limit the reaction. So sometimes we can't stop it, we can limit it. The first really occurs with emotional self-awareness, and this is why I encourage a lot of people to get downtime. And I carve out 15 to 30 minutes every morning, sometimes 45, and I'm going to sit there and I'm going to get mentally prepared for the day. That could be moments of gratitude, positive affirmation, setting my goals, but it also might be reflecting on how I showed up the day before. And if I allowed myself to be triggered, and you can write a book and you'll get triggered, believe me, that's why I'm such a student of this. And you have to sit there and reflect and say, now, why did I get triggered? And when I get triggered, what story am I starting to tell myself about that person, place, or event? And then how did it affect how I showed up? Now, once I go through that analysis and understand the why, what triggered me, then I can start planning the appropriate response. So with increased self-awareness, you can limit the response. Now, the second thing is, once you're able to be really highly conscious when you're getting triggered, best thing you can do is take two deep breaths. Remember, it's physiology 101. You're becoming oxygen deprived. So by breathing, you're actually getting you're getting oxygen back to that logical brain. And the third technique I would give people is just to state the emotion. I'm feeling frustrated. I'm feeling intimidated. I'm feeling small. I'm full of self-doubt. By stating the emotion, you actually take all that brain from the reptilian brain and it moves it back to the prefrontal cortex, the logical brain.
Oh, Colleen, I love that. And it sounds like when you can identify the emotion, it stops holding power over you.
Yes, and it's a great point because for two reasons. Many people think they are identifying the emotion. And I often tell my audiences, I think most of you have put your emotions into the witness protection program. because what most people do is we label a lot of things generically. So we will say we're upset. However, if you get downtime, reflection, you'll find you're not upset. You're actually feeling unappreciated. Two very different emotions, which requires a different solution. You might say you were frustrated when indeed you were intimidated. So that's the beauty of the downtime. You've got to get clear on what emotion you were feeling, because that's the only way you can apply the right solution to it. So if I'm feeling intimidated, I could rehearse and rehearse and rehearse my talk tracks, my presentation, all the good things that make me a professional verbally. But intimidation is a mindset game. It's not a verbal game. So I must then apply different tactics to change the mindset.
And what might those tactics be?
Well, again, what makes you intimidated? So most of the time, anything that's causing emotion is the story that you're telling yourself about that person, place, or situation. So I find that salespeople are great fiction writers. Many salespeople say they can't write. They absolutely can. You're making up a big story about this prospect, this peer, this colleague, friends. And so if you're making up a story anyway, why don't you make up a different story?
You know,
because a different story changes the emotion.
As you say that, I'm thinking, okay, what's happened in the times I've been intimidated? It's fear. It's shame. It's the old, I'm not good enough. I'm in over my head. It's these deep rooted fears that we really don't want to admit to anyone, not even ourselves.
Correct. Because, you know, really intimidation is an interesting one to take a look at, because you're right, we're ashamed to admit we're intimidated, but until you can own the emotion, you can't correct the emotion. Mm-hmm. But then when you start taking a look at it, okay, what is the reason? Well, many times, you know, there's lots of work done on sales call reluctance. Some people are intimidated by people of wealth. Some people are intimidated mm-hmm. by title. Some people just frankly, maybe you deserve to be intimidated because you didn't do the proper pre-call planning.
Right.
Well, so, sometimes you deserve it because all of a sudden that person is asking perfectly logical questions that they should have asked, any prospect would ask during a meeting, and you didn't prepare enough. Now that goes back to delayed gratification. You didn't put in the work to run a well-designed sales call.
You know, I could go so long on this subject because I find emotions fascinating too. I don't know if you saw or heard a Brené Brown interview. And what I find so fascinating about this is, Colleen, one of the things you so accurately mentioned is you have to be able to name the emotion in order to get control over it, have the self-awareness. And Brené said that when she did an experiment, she did a scientific study and asked hundreds, maybe thousands of people to identify the emotions that they had been feeling in the last 6 months. And evidently, they could only come up with three distinct emotions.
That does not surprise me. That's what I call the generic emotion
yes.
labeling.
Yes.
And so, go ahead.
The three emotions I find interesting, and you couldn't be more right. Now I'm having this big aha after listening to you. They're happy, sad, and pissed off. And that's it. And we promised we
right.
wouldn't swear on this podcast, too. And see what I've just done?
Well, and what happens here is, if you take this a step further, you know, we talk a lot in sales training about relating to other people. Now, obviously, that's very important because likability is huge. It's the first step in building trust. However, you can't really relate to someone unless you know what's going on in their head. That starts with knowing what's going on in your head. So I can definitely spot when someone's feeling unappreciated because I'm in tune with that emotion myself.
Wow.
I can sense when somebody's feeling small because I have felt small before.
Brilliant. And I love what you say about the downtime, because you're right. I mean, if you're always thinking about these emotions, like, why did I show up that way? Why did I do that? Why did I feel small? You're going to feel really lousy if you're just in this sort of mania of, you know, event, doing. It's taking this time to self-reflect, which I really don't think any of us do enough of today, Colleen, probably myself included at times. Tell me about the different emotional intelligences that you talk about in your book. Obviously, we've talked about empathy, impulse control. What are the main, if you were to categorize the different intelligences, what are they?
Well, we subscribe to, we use an assessment from multi-health systems, so we will subscribe to about 15 competencies, and they can be anything from social responsibility to problem-solving to impulse control to self-actualization to assertiveness. And then there's obviously some that are glaring to me when I see salespeople not achieving the success they could. So let's just take assertiveness, for example, and in the Corporate Executive Board, their research showed that, you know, great salespeople are assertive. What's interesting about that, I don't think many people linked this, that assertiveness is an emotional intelligence skill, not a selling skill, right? And so you've got salespeople that are assertive, which means they state nicely what they need. And so what you need on a sales call is a partnership. And, you know, if you do your win-loss analysis, that really means that I need to speak with this decision maker in order to make a right recommendation. If it's all data-driven, and salespeople know that because the data shows every time I lose a proposal, it's because I missed the buying influence. Mm-hmm. However, it's assertiveness that allows you to state what you need to stay in the game. So that's one small example. Assertiveness also is very big when I'm working with reps on uncovering budget. because, you know, in many cases, if you're selling a product to a prospect that's never purchased before, they are going to give you a very predictable answer. I have no idea. Please put something together. And the rep lacking assertiveness goes along to get along. And I finally write a lot of practice proposals.
Right. So what you're saying is, with a lack of assertiveness, the salesperson believes them and then spends 4 hours writing up a proposal, never to be called back, of course.
Or they come back and they say this is too high, which tells you that the prospect had a budget.
Interesting.
The salesperson just wasn't assertive enough to uncover it.
Interesting. So you even recommend some great techniques. What I love about your book on emotional intelligence is you not only talk about the emotional intelligence skills, but then you actually offer scripts. Most books that I've read would have one or the other. You know, here's the soft skills you need, but you've combined the soft with the hard. And I'd love you to share some of the techniques in the book as well. When we get resistant.
So, right. And so I think this is an important piece that, you know, I think effective training, sales training, sales management training, leadership training, any kind of training, it isn't an either-or proposition. I believe there's hard skills that need to be learned and taught, and there are the soft skills, emotional intelligence skills. The emotional intelligence skills helps with the consistent execution of the hard skills. So let's say, for example, you've got a prospect and it's a wishy-washy prospect, and you are just working really hard, and you can't find that term that we call in sales training, the pain, the problem, the challenge.
Right.
So the highly self-aware rep, the highly confident rep, will stop the call and just have a truth-telling conversation and say, you know, Bob or Joan, we're having a good conversation today. However, I don't know if I'm hearing enough reason for you to change, invest, or move. What am I missing?
Wow.
And we call the sales elephant in the room. We got a big elephant in our training center here in Denver. But see, that's a combination of soft skills, but the hard skill is saying it very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just a truth-telling moment. And it can be the game changer in a conversation where a prospect might sit there and agree, you're right, there's no reason. That's fine. Get to know facts. Get to the truth fast.
That's great. And that really does require so much confidence. But even with that assertiveness, by giving them the script, the what to say, along with the how to say it, you really come full circle, don't you?
Right. So that's where I think we've had a one-sided equation here on wondering why they're not executing the script. And scripts are great. I always find it fascinating when people want to avoid scripts, because I tell my managers and CEOs, if your salespeople knew what to say, they would. Give them a script to get started. Then they can get creative and customize, right?
Exactly. Right. They don't know. Give them what to say, and then you tell them the how to say it. Is that what I hear you saying?
Right.
Right. Great.
Well, you actually give them a talk track, but then when they're not executing, often what sales organizations do, they keep throwing more of the hard sales skills, the coaching, at the salesperson instead of backing up and saying, okay, what's the EQ skill missing here? And if it's, for example, if it's self-regard, this might be a person that's actually intimidated by calling at the top, and that could be due to the self-talk. This person's got a big title, big office, they make more money than me. So they know they're supposed to talk to the economic buyer, but the self-talk is holding them back. And they might make the phone call. They might actually make the phone call or make the contact, but they sound pitiful when they do.
Right.
So they actually showed up, but they didn't show up very well.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's almost like they're apologizing for asking them to buy something.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. So how do you, I'm thinking of empathy in particular, and I've been curious to ask you this, Colleen. How do you teach someone to really care when really they're in that fear zone, they're in their reptilian brain, and yet they've got to, you know, pay their mortgage, or they've got to pay a medical bill, and now all of a sudden you're saying you really need to care and you really need to like that person. How is that skill taught?
Well, the very, very basic of empathy is, it's pretty simple, it's paying attention. And there's some interesting research done by Sherry Turkle. She wrote the book, Bringing Back Conversation in the Digital Age. And this isn't a pick on the college-age kids, but empathy has gone down 40% in that group of students.
Wow.
And it's because everybody is on their technology. And the only way you can teach empathy is to know how something landed on another person. And so it's a paying attention skill. So if you take a look, even in Monday morning meetings, everyone's got their head down in their computers and their check-in meetings. And so even the managers aren't really highly attuned to what's going on because everybody's checked into their technology so much. So number one, you just got to teach people to pay attention, which is harder than you think today. And then the second piece is, it's simply, again, asking that question, what else could be going on here? And really allowing yourself to move into a prospect's shoes and see the world from their purview. So if you've got a hostile prospect, there's a pretty good chance that the last salesperson in there selling them something overpromised and underdelivered. So now their feelings are, I'm stupid, I trusted this person, I was treated unfairly, and my time was wasted. So, you know, it's not hard, but it does take time. But time means you've got to pay attention.
Well, and it, I love what you said about watching how it lands. And I'm thinking about technology and information overload and, you know, obviously reducing attention span. I always say it's not a problem of attention span. It's a problem of interest span. We're not holding their interest because it's not about them. You're absolutely right. Go ahead.
Well, and there's a little bit of where I push back a little bit on the attention span. Because, as you know, and you're in the same world, you're facilitating, instructing, and teaching, and so we're being told the attention span for 7 minutes. Now, personally, I don't even watch someone in my workshop that has the attention span of 7 minutes. Because if they cannot focus longer than 7 minutes, they cannot run a consultative sales call for an hour. End of story. So I believe we've got to quit buying into some of that myth. Now, yes, in training, we've got to change it up, et cetera. But for heaven's sake, folks, my husband just had his hip replaced, and I'm so glad his surgeon didn't have to leave the surgery every 7 minutes because he didn't have the ability to focus.
Right.
So I think we need to start changing some of the rules and sales and quit buying some of these myths.
I couldn't agree with you more. That's a great point. So I imagine the surgery went on for longer than 7 minutes.
Yeah, it went on for 2 hours, and actually the surgeon lives in our neighborhood, and so it's so funny. Just took a walk with him because I was home taking care of my husband. And I was trying to tell him this whole attention span thing that is occurring in sales. And he looked at me, and I could tell he didn't even know what I was talking about. So I just said, never mind. It's just kind of a story that's going around that people can't focus longer than 7 minutes. And he just smiled, and we continued walking.
Right, because he's probably not using his cell phone and his Game Boy while he's cutting, I would imagine.
No, he's not, and we don't need to be either. So I think this is a technology is a wonderful thing. However, I do not believe we've learned how to manage it to our full effectiveness yet.
I absolutely agree with you. Colleen, let me ask you, you've had such an incredible career. Mm-hmm. You've got a very successful training company. You've been named one of the top 50 sales and marketing influencers. You were vice president of sales for Varsity Spirit Corporation. Of all the things you've done, what are you most proud of?
You know, I'm a kid from Iowa, so you're supposed to be very humble. So I always want the answer to reflect that. You know, I'd say there's a couple of things. I would say when I received a promotion to vice president of sales at Varsity, that was a big moment for me because I had a lot of self-doubt. I actually turned down the position, and to the CEO's credit, he sat down with me and really encouraged me. Jeff Webb, he's now the chairman of Varsity Spirit Corporation. And I remember I was doing the impression management saying, no, I just want to remain as a sales manager. And when we had the truth-telling conversation, I finally stepped up and I said, I'm not ready to be a VP of sales. My self-talk was, I'm not ready. And I'll never forget, he looked at me and he said, we know, we're going to help you get ready. And I will share with you, I had more help from the CFO, the GM, colleagues. So that was a big win for me. I'd also just say, though, the daily emails, I know, Sherry, you get a lot of these. It's from clients that just say, I applied what you taught. and this is what happened, and it was a game changer. I have to tell you, that one thrills me as much as anything I've accomplished.
You know, Colleen, I got the chills when you said that. And I'm thinking about your emotional intelligence and really your confidence, I suppose, your assertiveness to be able to say to your boss, I'm not ready. What did that take for you to do that? And then look how it turned out. You know, you look at how the truth turns out, right?
Right. And I like to give him the credit because he dug past the typical excuse. No, not ready. No. I think I'm going to move to Colorado. And took the time when somebody else might have said, well, gosh, you know what? She doesn't want this position. So I would say his antenna was up saying there's something else here.
Very
attention.
And it worked. And how long were you with them?
I worked for Varsity Spirit Corporation for 10 years.
And what does Varsity Spirit Corporation do for those that don't know?
They are quite an American success story. So they started out as the David and the David and Goliath story, selling cheerleading, dance, and camp to schools and universities. So if you see the National Cheerleading Championships, Dance Championships on ESPN, that's the company. And since then, they've even purchased more companies. They own Herf Jones, the Class Ring company. They go out to schools and actually sell branding and spirit to schools and universities. So it's a really nice success story because it is definitely a startup that went big.
And you ran sales. And had you been introduced to the idea of emotional intelligence back then?
No, I could have used some serious training back then. I was a bull in a china shop.
So are you going to share with
us? I lost out.
How did you learn? How did you get there, not having the distinction for it back then?
Well, you know, I would say that the reason I had success is people always knew my intentions. So I was not a political person. I've always been a very, very hard worker. And I always believed that I had bosses that were more mature than me. So I'm pretty sure behind closed doors, they were saying, you know, I wish she'd say it differently, but she has such a great passion for this business. I know her intention is pure. And so I think that got me a long ways in life.
That's wonderful, wonderful. And how did you start your training company? What happened?
Well, I resigned from Varsity after 10 years. I'd always loved the training piece. I had built out their training program. And I took a few months off, about 10 months off on the beach, just to figure out what my next move was. And so I really got clarity that I loved teaching and I wanted to be in the training, development, and speaking world. So then I moved out to Denver, Colorado, and I was single. I didn't know anyone. And I got on board with Sandler Sales Training, and I was an associate with them for 3.5 years. So I sold, trained, coached, and then in 2001, I spun off my own business.
And it's been a success story from there. That is just wonderful. What is the best advice you've ever been given? It sounds like you've had at least one or two fabulous mentors. What's the best advice?
Well, this does come from another fabulous mentor, Klein Boyd. And I can't quite remember the situation, Sherry, but I was feeling discouraged about something. I think it was some self-doubt. I can't remember the situation, but I remember he looked me directly in the eye and he says, Colleen, don't let anyone or anything change you. And that has just resonated many times in my life when, you know, maybe I'm having, you know, I'm wanting to compromise or, you know, maybe not act in the manner I'd like to, and I know it's the right manner, and that little voice just comes, don't let anyone or anything change you. So it keeps me going on the straight and narrow.
Do you ever get nervous?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I would say, I'm trying to think of, you know, I did a conference in New York about a month ago, and I was nervous. I'm also very prepared, though. So my self-managing strategy is I over-prepare. And so that works for me. I'm comfortable doing it. So I would say where I get nervous is when I don't use that strategy and I'm not showing up prepared. Then it's going to be the wrong kind of nervous. Doesn't serve me well.
So when you say nervous, was the feeling nervous or is it excited and nervous?
I would say I was excited and nervous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting talking to speakers about that. I find that even the most proficient speakers, such as yourself and others that are talking in front of big audiences, they get nervous. Barbara Streisand says she still throws up the night before she does a performance. So I guess that means you're on your game.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if you're not a little nervous, and I don't know if this is the right attitude to have, but you should have a little nervousness, because I think that actually shows a respect for the audience. And maybe that's not the right thinking, but to me, it just means that I really want to deliver because they're here for a reason. I know how much I value my time. And I also know when I've heard a great speaker, it can be one or two gems I walk away with, and it can really just make a huge difference. So one small tidbit, big difference. So that's the goal.
Yeah, yeah. Now, tell us a little bit for our listeners, if someone were to hire you to come in, would you be doing a keynote? Would you be doing a facilitation? What's the best way to work with a sales team of maybe, 75 to 150 reps?
Good question. You know, there's various ways. A lot of times we'll start with a sales kickoff, and that can be a keynote that can then followed by a breakout. And then after that, they may bring us in for more in-depth sales training, consulting, and that can vary. That just varies, as you know, Sherry, with the amount of work you do. It can be anything from how do we bring in better leads, more qualified leads, to the sales process, to account management. And then we also love working with the leadership, because that's really where the change happens. And frankly, I think a lot of sales managers are set up to fail. They absolutely do not get the training and education they need. So I've got a great passion around that as well.
Yeah, you talk about that at the end of the book, about changing a culture with emotional intelligence. Do you have any stories that you can share with our audience about how you've done that? Because you're absolutely right. You know, it's like the movie Buck. I love the scene where, you know, everybody wants their horse trained, and Buck says, you know, reveals that it's not the horse that needs to be trained. It's the owner. Right. It's the same thing, right? The managers are always saying they need to do this, they need to do that. And they don't have a mirror anywhere close. So can you share maybe a story about that?
Well, you know, one company we just recently worked with, they have, they're really intent on up-leveling their sales program. So they went through our sales training program. We helped them create a sales playbook. And as part of the playbook, we decided to hold some, quote, values workshops. So we brought in everyone from the company three different times, and it's kind of an informal workshop I do, but on how do you bring the values in your company alive. So everybody says we have respect, teamwork, integrity, and what I always challenge people to do, and with this company I did the same thing, I said, what does teamwork look like, and what's lack of teamwork look like? I wanted them to put a behavior, an action, or a scenario to it. And it was fascinating, because that becomes the game changer. So right there, that's now incorporated into their onboarding manual with anybody that comes on at the company. This is actually what teamwork looks like. This is what integrity looks like. You don't leave a customer hanging on the phone. You actually wait. You transfer the call. You take care of it, even if it's not in your area. But the fact that they created the scenarios, that's what made it powerful. So I would say that's one recent example we have.
That's terrific, because otherwise it's just a saying on a plaque, right? It's not usable and actionable. You know, it's just something in the brain.
Not.
Yeah.
It's like what the Heath brothers write about in their book, Made to Stick. We often speak in very intangible language, but the only way people can change or learn is you've got to make something tangible. So values have to become very tangible. We don't do this, we do this.
Sounds like parenting, Colleen. Little bit. I'm a new parent, so I'm learning. If you could have one do-over, what would that be?
I would get very, very proactive on seeking out mentors. I think I've had some good mentors in my life, and that's been lucky. But I believe if I'd been more intentional about seeking out people, seeking their wisdom, it could have shortcutted a lot of my learnings and avoided a few bumps along the way. So that would be one do-over I would take a strong look at.
And how would you tell our listeners to find a mentor? Because I couldn't agree with you more. I owe every success in my life because of really just a handful of phenomenal mentors. How do you find one?
Well, I think you just, it's that paying attention thing, Sherry. So I believe the first thing is you find people that you admire, not only from that professional competency, but also the character side of it, mm-hmm. because you can't have one without the other. And then, you know what, it's making a phone call and probably just saying what you fear. I know you're really busy. I'm looking to get better. And I wonder if I could get 15 minutes of your time. And then once you get 15 minutes, because even a very busy person will tell you, give you 15 minutes, you make sure you loop back with that mentor and tell them exactly how you applied the knowledge he or she gave you. That's what excites mentors. I think the reason people fall short in mentoring, they give lots of advice and people write it down and they either never apply it or they never get back to them on how they applied it.
Boy, that is such a beautiful point. So it's the emotional intelligence skill of assertiveness to start, because, you know, it can be scary to call your role model, your idol, whoever that may be. But I love what you just said about circle back up and tell them how you applied it and what it meant to them.
Right. And then guess what? They're going to want to mentor more because, you know, people that are successful, they have that whole, they have that usually that competency or that core value of they want to help people. But, you know, at the same time, they're limited on time. So they want to help people that are actually going to do something with the advice or direction.
That is just wonderful advice. One more question for you, Colleen. What, if anything, is too serious to be joked about?
Now, that's a hard question because I love humor, and I actually think in many cases it can diffuse volatile situations and actually give people different perspective. However, I would say genocide, hard to joke about, and domestic violence.
I'm right there with you. Right there with you. I said that was the last question, but there is going to be one more question that I want to ask you. We talked about it at the very beginning of the interview about all of the difficult things for salespeople, whether it's dropping price too soon, whether it's feature dumping. If you were to say one thing is the most difficult thing for salespeople to master, what would that be?
I would say it is discipline, because discipline precedes everything else. So let's just say the downtime. It takes discipline to get up 15 to 30 minutes earlier and then put in that routine. It takes discipline to manage your time, which means you've got a calendar block for a whole week, so you're very effective. It takes discipline to practice skills until you become unconsciously competent. It takes discipline to reach out to mentors. So I would say discipline precedes a lot of habits. And once you get habits in place, that's when life starts rolling along because they're good habits.
Well, it sounds like you've got quite a lot of discipline, Colleen, given your success and given the way you speak. So how can our audience get a hold of you either for a live training or they've got to get a hold of your book? I'm going to say this right now to all my listeners. If you do nothing else today, be assertive, have discipline, get off this call right now and go ahead and order Colleen Stanley's book because it is truly a classic. It's one of those that you need to have on your shelf forevermore. And it's not one you read once. It's one you go back to over and over again. How can we get our hands on your book, Colleen?
So the book, I would suggest going to Amazon.com, Emotional Intelligence for Sales Success, or it's in Barnes & Noble. And then if you want additional free resources, go to our website. That's also got our contact information for any other speaking and training that we do, and that's www.salesleadershipdevelopment.com.
Colleen, it has truly been a pleasure. And, you know, I'm going to get off the phone, and I'm going to go for a 28-minute walk right now because I got a lot to think about.
Good for you. I won't be able to do that for about 3 hours, but I'll be right there with you.
Well, I loved our walk. We met just a couple of months ago, and we went for a nice walk. I think it was about 118 degrees, but it was great to get to know you.
It was. And we were sweating at like 6:30 in the morning. But we were there.
We were there. We got up. We did it. We got up that 15 minutes earlier. We had the discipline, and we made it happen. Colleen, an absolute pleasure to get to know you better, to hear all of your wisdom, and to gain your mentorship. Thank you. This is Sherry Levitin with Colleen Stanley, Emotional Intelligence for Sales Success. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sherry.